We're doing our Parsha class. We'll do a quick overview of the Parsha. So we're holding Parshat Vayigash. The brothers came down to Egypt. We didn't have Parsha class last week, so we'll quickly recap. Paro had his dream. No one can interpret it but Yosef. Yosef tells him 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. Yosef advises him how to divide up Egypt so that they can save and have food for the years of famine. And Paro is taken by Yosef's brilliance, and he appoints him viceroy over Egypt. And Yosef marries Asnas, has two kids, and takes control of Egypt and gathers all the wealth. The 7 years of famine come. The brothers out in Canaan are thinking what they can do to get Yosef back, and they're running out of food, and Yaakov sends them down. Yosef summons them in. They don't recognize him. He recognizes them. He tells them, you guys are spies. You came here to spy out the land. Why did 10 brothers come in through 10 gates? We obviously want to spy and attack. And the brothers say, no. We're looking for a brother. We lost our brother. We're checking him out. And Yosef says, then why are you in all the brothels? So they obviously want to get information on the city, and that's where you figure you'll pay it off. And they say, no, we figured that's where we'll find our brother. We're looking. He was a good-looking guy. We sold him down here. We figured that's where they take him. But no. Okay, so Yosef puts him in custody, and by the third day he says, look, I'm scared of God. You have families at home. You have to bring food. In order to ensure that you guys aren't lying, you're going to leave one man here. I'm taking Shimon, putting him in jail. You guys bring the food home and come back. You promised me, you told me you have another brother you left at home. So don't try to trick me. If you want to come back and get food, you better bring that little one here. And I want to see that you're all brothers and you're really from one family. I'm going to interview him, interview you, and I'll check you guys out. They come back home. The father says, where's Shimon? Shimon has kids too, you know. Well, they tell him the whole story. Yaakov says, what'd you do to me? I'm missing Yosef, now I'm missing Shimon. You still want to take Binyamin? No way. I'm not sending Benjamin down with you guys. No way. Reuven says, you could kill my two kids if I don't bring them back. Give us Benjamin, we got to go. And Yaakov says, no, what kind of fool are you? Your kids are my kids. I don't want to kill your kids, and that's no collateral for me. No, you guys aren't taken down. Look at Benjamin. His own brother disappeared when I let him out of my sight. I'm not letting Benjamin go with you. Okay, the famine keeps up, and they're out of food, and the brothers are waiting respectfully. And finally, Yaakov tells them, go get us food. And Yehuda steps to the plate, and Yehuda says, we can't go. That viceroy of Egypt, he warned us not to show our faces without our little brother. If you give us Benjamin, we're going. And if not, we're not going. So Yehuda says, I take responsibility. I will personally be indebted to you forever if I don't bring him back safely. I am the one who is co-signing my responsibility. And Yaakov says, fine, God should bless you. He gives them gifts to bring from the dried fruits of Israel, and he sends them down. They come down, Yosef calls them in, brings out Shimon to be with them, and Yosef starts playing games with them. He invites them in for a meal. They say, you know, the money you sent with the money we paid suddenly showed up in our bags again. And the chief of staff says, no, we got your money. Your God must have given you guys a gift. Don't worry about it. They come back with extra money to pay for the new food. And Yosef takes them in and he parties and he starts dividing them according to their families. He says, ooh, he hits his goblet and he says, my goblet just told me, you Reuven, you used to sleep on the top bunk. Shimon, you used to sleep in the bunk across the hall from him. Weird, okay. Levi, your three are from the same mother. Levi, I see you were on the bottom bunk. You used to scratch your bed. He starts telling them things from their childhood. They look at one another. How does he know all this? Okay, they didn't recognize it's Yosef. And he keeps having an interpreter between them, so they don't even realize that it's him. He sees Benjamin. He says to him, hey, son, who are you? He says, I'm Benjamin. He says, really, are you married? Do you have kids? Benjamin says, sure, I have 10 kids. How did you name your kids? Who are they? So he starts telling him the 10 names. He says, what do these names mean? He says, well, each name is after my long-lost brother. I got married, he didn't see me. I had happiness, he isn't with me. I loved him, and he's not with me. He was beautiful, and he's not here. Every name reflects my long-lost brother. And when Yosef hears this, he's destroyed. He walks out of the room, goes into a side room, and starts crying. And when he can regain his composure, he washes his face, he comes out and says, okay, give everyone bread. So the Hebrews, his brothers sit alone, and he sits alone, and the Egyptians sit alone, because they eat meat, and the Egyptians wouldn't eat the cattle that they prayed to. Yosef and his brothers do. And they all drink wine together. And Yosef sends his son, Menashe, and he says, show them the knife, and show them how you slaughter the cattle, so they see it's a kosher shechita. So the brothers are shocked. How does an Egyptian know how to do that? And then Yosef calls Benjamin, and he says, son, you have no mother. I also have no mother. Your mother died at childbirth. My mother died at childbirth. We'll eat together. He sits Benjamin down at his table, and he sits all the brothers according to their ages and families, and they couldn't figure out how does he know all this. And during the meal, he keeps hitting his goblet and saying, oh, my goblet told me this, my goblet told me that, and he's telling them all kinds of secrets. At the end of this lavish meal, he sends them off, and he says he wishes them well, and he tells his chief of staff, show them that you're giving them back their money, and when you load their bags, and the little one, the youngest one, you stick in my goblet. Okay, they stick in the goblet, no one sees, they load all the food, and the brothers leave, they're going with their donkeys, and he sends his son Menashe, his younger son Menashe, with the army chasing after them. They catch up to them, and they say, what's wrong with you guys? How could you do that to us? We were so nice to you. How do you do such an evil thing to us? And the brothers say, what do you want? And they say, you really think that our master isn't smart? If he figured everything else out, you don't think he would have figured out you guys stole his goblet? You think he needs the goblet to know everything? He knows everything without his goblet too. Give back the goblet, you thieves. The brothers say, what do you mean? We brought back money that turned up, which you say isn't even your money. We were so honest, we brought back extra money. You think we'd steal something? How could you even say such a thing? So the chief of staff, Menashe, says, unload your bags, we're searching all of you. And of course, he knows where he's going to find the goblet, so he starts at the other end. He starts with the eldest brother, and he works his way down, emptying out each sack. And the brothers say, you see, it's not here. And finally, they reach Benjamin's sack, and there's the goblet. The brothers look at him, and they start banging him between his shoulder blades, and they say, you bum, you're just like your mother. You're a thief, the son of a thief. They each tear their clothing. They're destroyed. They said, kill the one who you catch with the goblet, and the rest of us will be slaves. And now, then Benjamin was caught with the goblet. Uven kitefav shachin. Benjamin's blessing is, between his shoulder blades, God rests. Our sages say, Yehi chelki mimi shechashdu bo ve'in bo. May my lot be with those who were suspect of something, they were suspected of something, and really they were innocent. And so Benjamin, in the merit of all the bangs he got between his shoulder blades, he gets the Shekhinah in his portion. We can't have questions. We're just running very short on time. We haven't even started our parsha yet. All of this is introductory. So the brothers come back before Yosef. Their clothes are in tatters. And we have to remember that the story began with torn clothing. It all began when Yosef came with his beautiful clothing that they ripped off of him and tore into shreds and brought it to the father. They come with the torn, bloody garment. And now our story is coming to a close with all the brothers standing there with torn garments. They're standing in front of Yosef. What are they going to say? And Yehuda says, what can I say? God obviously found our sin. This isn't natural, your majesty. This is us being paid back for something we should have done differently many years ago. And Yehuda steps forward. Last week's parsha ended on a very stressful note. Yehuda says, what can I say? God obviously found us guilty. So we're all going to be servants. What can we say? And Yosef says, no, why would I do that? You guys all go home in peace. Why? One guy's a thief. I'll just hold on to him. The rest of you go home. I have nothing against you. Go. So Yosef's a nice guy. And that's where our parsha begins. What's Yehuda supposed to say? Yosef just told him, I don't need all of you. You guys go home. There's one guy who's a thief. He's staying here. He's... Vayigash elav Yehuda. Our parsha begins where Yehuda steps forward. And you guys know the story, or should we do an overview of the story? Should we do an overview of the story? Everyone knows the story more or less, right? Yehuda comes forward, and finally Yosef tells them it's him, and then he sends the brothers back with gifts, and he brings his father down to Egypt, and the brothers live in Goshen, and that's really the end of the story. So they're standing there in this suspenseful moment. The brothers are standing in tears. Their clothing are torn. Benjamin, the brothers have all suspected him to be a thief, like his mother stole the trephim from her father. Vayigash elav Yehudah, and I want to maybe go off on a small tangent. I've had numerous times where there were people who had very powerful arguments with one another. And very often, when you come to a very powerful argument, so one side presents their case very powerfully, and they convince you. And then they say, now you got to do this. And there are many stories I could tell you. I could tell you just from the last half a year how many stories I've encountered this way. Where you had an employee, an employer. The employee claimed that the employer embarrassed her in public, embarrassed her in front of other workers, treated her unfairly, didn't pay her on time, didn't pay her what he owed her. Million claims. And very often people get you all riled up and they want you to take their side and attack with them or be on their side and defend them. And we have to remember that the first point is go to the other side. Don't attack. Vayigash elav Yehuda. Yehuda goes over to him. Very often we're tempted to bash him over the head. Wait, go over to him. See what's really going on. I was in a shul once where I was supposed to help out setting up the Yom Kippur davening. And in the middle of Yom Kippur, everyone's very focused. Davening is very serious. These are people who don't often get together in shul. One guy's cell phone goes off. So we're standing there, Yom Kippur davening, and suddenly you hear a tune. Let's say, for argument's sake, it's Jingle Bells. Okay? So the guy smiles, takes out his cell phone, walks outside, and has his conversation. Okay, whatever. Comes back in, puts the cell phone in his pocket, continues davening. 5 minutes later, the cell phone rings again. You can understand that people are getting very on edge. The third time it happens, people come to me and they say, look, we brought you here because we wanted you to lead a Yom Kippur davening. That guy is doing something terrible. It's not only that he brought his cell phone, and it's not only that he's answering it on Yom Kippur. If you don't go up to him and protest in front of the crowd, you should know that you have let us all down, and from now on, people will come to shul with their cell phones. You're here in a community where people do walk with cell phones on Shabbos. That's what we brought you for. So if you're going to be a spiritual leader here, if you're going to help us move forward on Yom Kippur, you know, they brought me in as a guest here and there, but you know, on Yom Kippur, you better bang on the bima and say, this is not acceptable. This does not happen in this shul and shouldn't happen in any shul. If a person isn't embarrassed that they're already answering the phone to begin with, they should at least, on Yom Kippur, how could you? And then they started telling me, you know, and if you don't do it, then in the future, we might never be able to prevent cell phones from ringing on Shabbos in our shul. Right now, everyone knows they come to shul with their cell phones off, or not with their cell phones. These are obviously, you have a lot of people there who are not religious, and you will ruin it for us for all the future. We fought so hard to have a shul where the cell phones don't go off on Shabbos. So the pressure's up. And I'm standing there, you know, little old me, what do I know from the shul politics? What do I know from the cell phones? And the people who brought me there, the people who had faith in me, you know, they're the ones who asked me to come. They're the ones telling me, you got to stand up to the plate. This is what, you know, if you're not doing this, then everything you've done is worthless.
Well, what a pressure.
they bring the Sifrei Torah back, and it's my job to stand up there and say something. So I said a Dvar Torah, and I see people staring at me, waiting for me to say something, and I didn't say anything. And I was standing there with a lot of thought, like, what am I supposed to do now? I don't know the parties involved, but I can't embarrass a person publicly on Yom Kippur. Can't embarrass him publicly any day. On Yom Kippur, I'm going to do this. I'm going to embarrass him publicly. He's wrong, but there has to be a different way to deal with this. And I could see people were seething at me. At the end of davening, there was a line of people telling me, you should know that if this happens next Shabbos because of you, we are not coming back to this shul. So now, done, right? I destroyed the shul. I said, look, I have to deal with it. You're right. But I don't think you have a right to embarrass a person publicly. I'm going to deal with it, but not like this. I didn't go home during the break. I went to this guy's house. I come to his house. They tell me he's waiting for me at the apartment I was supposed to be at. Okay, I'm wondering what he's waiting for. So I figure, you know, silence is always a good way to start things. Let him say the first sentence. So I come to him with a big smile, and he says to me, I hear you went to my house. I was waiting for you here. What'd you go to my house for? So I figure I'm not going to say anything. Let me first hear what he has to say. So I said, I'll tell you in a minute. You came here. What'd you come for? So he says to me, my mother's in the hospital, and they kept calling me with questions about what to do with her. And now I'm at a point where I'm not sure, should I drive to the hospital or not? And he starts laying out before me what the question is. What would have happened had I said something? Yeah. So I did say something. That afternoon, everyone came back for Mincha. So I spoke to the crowd, and I told them, you know, there was a person here who did a very responsible thing, as much as it bothered all of us. He brought his cell phone. Maybe he forgot before Yom Tov to put it on vibrate. Maybe he wouldn't have felt it on vibrate. If he would have asked me, maybe I would have told him to leave the tune on because he had no choice. And you know, right now he's driving as we speak. I told him to drive to the hospital because there are important medical decisions he has to make. Different story, right? To my mind, that's the first three words of the parasha. Vayigash elav Yehuda. The first rule in conflict is go over to the other side. See what they have to say. And very often we skip that. We assume we know. Vayigash elav, go over, go see. So Yehuda goes over to him. And tomorrow, Bezrat Hashem, we will learn the medrash about the difficult words Yehuda said to Yosef, the threats that went back and forth between Yehuda and Yosef. There are fantastic midrashim here. There's a medrash that says that when Yehuda got upset, he'd take lead in his mouth and he'd start chewing on it. And as he'd chew on this lead, it would melt and drip down his cheek, and his eye would start bleeding, and he'd have blood dripping down from his eye, mixing with the lead. And he had a hair on his chest that would stand up and protrude through I don't know how many garments that he'd have, like a spear. And he stood there and he says to Yosef, I've had it with you. I know why you want this beautiful guy. You want him like all Egyptians for your promiscuity. No, this isn't going to happen. And Yehuda starts thumping with his foot and he lets out a roar. Now Yehuda has a nephew, Dan. His brother Dan has a son named Hushim ben Dan. Hushim ben Dan is deaf. So the Medrash says, Yehuda started yelling in Egypt. He started roaring, Gura Ye Yehuda. Yehuda is like a lion. And his nephew in Canaan heard it, his deaf nephew in Canaan. Hushim ben Dan hears that his uncle is upset. So he comes and he starts roaring too. And the two of them are standing there ready to destroy Egypt. And Bezrat Hashem tomorrow will learn the Medrash, the discussion that went back and forth, exactly how Yehuda planned on destroying Egypt, and the dangers that Yosef faced at that time. But we have to ask another question. Our parsha is the threshold. In our parsha, we begin a dismal part of Jewish history where the Jews leave Israel. The Jews go down to Egypt. And this is going to be a scene that will replay itself. And I want to address maybe the most difficult question in these parshiyot in a roundabout way. Imagine that you're Yosef HaTzadik. You're in Egypt, and you know that the Jewish people have to come down to Egypt. And you know you had these dreams, you have this prophetic vision from your grandfather already, that the Jews are coming down to Egypt. And you also know that it's been 20 years since your brothers sold you into slavery and they haven't come looking. Now that there's a famine, they come down to Egypt. So Yosef is faced with a question. If the Jews come down to Egypt now, they're coming down tainted with the worst possible sin. They sold their brother into slavery? Into prostitution, according to the Midrash. And the one strength that they can have in Egypt is their unity. How are they going to withstand the 400 years that await them when they're walking in with such a stain on their soul? The brothers sold Yosef. And now they're going to come down to Mitzrayim. How can a people that sold their own brother, as legitimate as it was with all the Midrashim at the end of the day, how are they going to last in Mitzrayim? So Yosef is faced with this question, what am I going to do? They're going to come down and they haven't fixed that sin. Proof of the pudding is they never came searching for me. As much as Yosef suffered all those years, no one sent word, no one came to check, how's Yosef doing? Let's assume all their calculations were right. Yosef deserves it, and Yosef deserved worse, and everything, but you sold him into slavery, you don't go check how your brother is. So that's a very hefty sin on their record. And coming off of that, they're going to enter a foreign territory under Egyptian rule. How are they ever going to last? So Yosef has a problem. And so, what solution? How can he help them stand up to the test that awaits them? So the only way Yosef can do that is what he does now. He puts them in a situation where history repeats itself, only worse. They sold Yosef, it was their own initiative. They held he deserved it. Now Binyamin deserved to be taken into custody. They were set free. They're inactive. It's not their fault. Binyamin's the thief. What did they do? And in spite of that, they're going to risk their lives and they're going to put their lives on the line saying to Yosef, no, we're not going to let this happen. And that's what Yosef wanted to see. And in so doing, Yosef allowed them to take steps forward in rectifying what they did in the past. Because now, this was the only opportunity the brothers had. What could they do now? They can't buy him out of slavery. He's not a slave anymore. How could they ever make it up to him? How could they ever fix that sin? How could they ever do tshuva for it? Yosef put them in a situation where they did. Yosef put them in a corner where they could have said, what can we do, Binyamin? It's your fault. Who asked you to steal the goblet? Goodbye, Binyamin. You did it to yourself. Why should we stand up for you? But they don't. As we will see tomorrow, they're ready to take on all of Egypt in battle, but they're not going to give up on that one brother. They show that they have fixed what they did wrong then. And then Yosef can reveal himself. And that's what Yosef tells them. He tells them, don't worry, I can't do anything to you guys. And I'm not going to do anything to you guys. We're all candles. And just like 10 candles couldn't put out one definitely can't put out 10. Yeah? But he's representing everyone. And according to the Medrash, they were all getting ready for war. That's why I said, we'll see the details tomorrow, Bezalel Shem.
How the brothers were getting ready for war against Yosef. You know what I mean? To say that how could they ever get ready?
Yeah, the brothers were getting ready to have a war with all the Egyptians, Yosef and the other Egyptians, in order to save Binyamin. Yeah. So, Yosef sees his big brother Yehuda breaking up before him. where Yosef is victorious in their oral debate, and he sees his brothers embarrassed in front of everyone, and he can't handle that. So Yosef kicks everyone out, and he reveals himself to the brothers. Chazal say, he said, "Oh, you guys want your brother Yosef? I have him here in the palace." The brothers say, "Really? Where is he?" So he says, "I'll call him in right now." "Yosef, Yosef, come on in." The brothers look to the left. He looks to the right and he starts calling, "Yosef, come on in." The brothers look to the right. He looks to the back of the room. He says, "Yosef, Nu, why aren't you coming in?" The brothers look to the back of the room. He takes them in every direction, calling, "Yosef, Yosef, where are you?" Finally, he turns to them and he says, "He's right here before you. It's me." So the brothers are shocked. What are they going to say? Chazal say, that shock that the brothers had that moment when suddenly, "Hey, it's me," that's the shock that we're each going to have when Hashem brings us to Judgment Day. Meaning, we live in this facade, we live in this this fake world where we feel like everything's okay. Chazal say, "Oy lanu miyom adin, oy lanu miyom atochicha. Woe to us from the day of judgment, woe to us from the day of proof." There comes a point where Hashem says, "I'm going to prove to you exactly who you are. I'm going to take off all the facade and I'll show you. This is what you were thinking at this minute." And Hashem even proves it, ourselves versus ourselves. "Here you said this is important, so why'd you do that? Here you said that's important. When you judged others, you judged this way. When you behaved yourself, you did that way." And then there's a stunned silence. What can he say? Yosef tries to placate them. He says to them, "This was meant to be. It was already predestined we'd come down to Egypt, and Hashem just took care of us that it would happen in a way that I could take care of you. Hashem sent me here. Look at what good came out of this whole story. Because you sent me down here, that's why everyone's alive. The whole world is benefiting from this whole story. Hashem sent me down here. So it's not you who did this. Look, Hashem took care of it. Look, I'm responsible here. Go quickly, tell my father that Hashem put me in charge of all of Egypt. Come down, don't stay there. And you'll live in Goshen. What's special about the land of Goshen?" So there are a few things special. One is that the land of Goshen is not mixed within the Egyptians. So whenever Jews lived in a ghetto, it was to their benefit. This way, they didn't have foreign influences. They could have good education. They could bring up their kids in the environment they chose. The second thing is that the land of Goshen belonged to them. When Pharaoh abducted Sarah, so then after he was punished, so he regretted it. So he gave her a bunch of gifts. One of the gifts he gave her was Hagar, his daughter. One of the gifts he gave her was the land of Goshen. So he says to him, you know, "We'll live in the territory that we own. You're coming to the land of Goshen. And I'll take care of you. I can't send the food out." Yosef tells them politically, "If I start sending food outside Egypt every month, they're going to suspect that I'm setting up storage houses out in Canaan. Once they discover I come from there, they're not going to let me get away with that. So my faithfulness to the country is in question. I can't do that. I can sustain you if you come here. But look, I'm talking to you." Says Rashi, what language was he talking? Lashon HaKodesh. The Ramban disagrees with Rashi here and in a few other places. He says Avram Avinu came from Ur Kasdim, and there the language was Aramean, Aramis. Just like we find Lavan speaks Aramis. So the idea, Yosef tells them, "Look, I speak Lashon HaKodesh." That's not a complete proof. Rashi says, he said to them, "Look, how do I know Hebrew? That's how you'll know I'm Yosef." The Ramban says it's not such a proof, because in the land of Canaan, everyone was talking Lashon HaKodesh. Avram Avinu didn't talk Lashon HaKodesh. The Arameans spoke Aramean, Aramis, Armenian, whatever it is, I don't know. Aramid, Aramaic, yeah, Aramaic. Okay, so that's here. This is an important Ramban because he's disagreeing with the Kuzari.
The Canaanites spoke Hebrew?
The Ramban says the Canaanites spoke Hebrew, the Arameans spoke Aramaic. Avram Avinu spoke Aramaic. That's what the Ramban says. Now, this is in difference with the Kuzari, who says that Avram was called Ha'ivri because he spoke Ivrit, because he continued the language of Aver, he continued Hebrew. So he kisses his brothers, he weeps with them, and then they start talking. Hey, where you been? What's happened? And they start talking. And Yosef promises them never to tell his father what happened. And so, although Yosef is going to reunite with his father, he is not going to reveal to his father what happened, and he will always take care to keep a distance from his father, so that there are always other people around, and his father could never ask him, hey, what happened those 20 years? He leaves that as something silent. Yaakov Avinu will regain his prophecy, and out of prophetic vision, he will understand what happened. Paro invites the brothers. Paro is happy to have them there. And our sages say that technically, when it was decreed that we would serve in Egypt, what should have happened is a bunch of pirates should have come and abducted Yaakov Avinu and all the family and taken them down in shackles and sold them into slavery in Egypt. Hashem loved Yaakov, and in the merits of the forefathers, so Hashem made it that we came down to Egypt pleasantly. We came down as wealthy people, we came down as nobles, we came down by invitation from Pharaoh. And because of this, we also have a mitzvah. We have a mitzvah that says, Lotitaev mitzri. You're not allowed to have a revolting attitude. That you find the Egyptians revolting because you were a sojourner in their land. Meaning, here we had a time of need. We didn't have enough food in Canaan. So the Egyptians took us in. They took us in. We have a mitzvah not to treat them completely badly. We have to be careful how we treat the Egyptians. And even though ultimately they became worse than the Nazis, the Egyptians murdered our babies, the Egyptians did anything horrible under the sun that you could imagine. Nonetheless, we have this mitzvah because here in our parsha, they took us in our time of need. Paro makes an exception. He tells Yosef, you guys take calves out of Egypt, take wagons to bring everyone here. And this is exceptional because ordinarily you couldn't take calves out of Egypt. The Egyptians had a special way of bringing up their cows, and they wouldn't let any cow leave Egypt without taking out its womb to ensure that no one else could compete with them. It's like the great wheat manufacturers do today. You know, they do genetic alterations so that all the wheat you buy from them doesn't produce more wheat. If you plant it, you can't grow more wheat. Because they want to ensure to minimize competition. So at any rate, that was what happened in Egypt, and here he made this exception. And we did have the parsha to be continued, Bezalel Shem, tomorrow night.